Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Thank you for coming to an emergency weekend edition IL Indoor Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined by Steven Stamp for the first time since July. Steven, I think it's safe to say that you are no longer in Israel.
It is safe to say I'm no longer in Israel. That was a lot of fun doing the ones from Israel. The nice thing now is no time delay. There's no lag on the recording.
Exactly right. That being said, there is a lot of time sensitivity because late on Thursday, we learned that the NLL had announced the cancellation of its first two weekends of action in the 2018-19 season, that resulting from an extended negotiation with the Pro Lacrosse Players Association on a new collective bargaining agreement. Just Thursday morning, you posted that there was some hope regarding the salvaging of the first several games of the season. The seven games so far have been canceled. And then, I guess, basically, it's safe to say this was a surprise when it came out at the end of the day on Thursday that this was the stance that the league was taking.
A little bit. I just because the big sticking points, well, I mean, there's lots of little issues about per diems and mileage reimbursement and missed work pay and things that have been kind of going back and forth. And honestly, the league has acquiesced on a number of those issues, probably, I mean, two-thirds of the issues that were being contested. The league has granted some things to the players. And I think the big thing, the two big items left were length of term. The league had originally asked for 8 years. They dropped that to 7 years with the possibility to opt out after six, so basically a six-year contract. And the players were moving up and come up to 4 years. But the players originally were saying, you know, very few years. They wanted a short contract. And the big reason for that from the players' perspective is there's all this talk of growth. Everything's supposed to be taking off. The league's supposed to be growing and building, and there's supposed to be a lot more, and they want to share in that growth. And from the league's perspective, if they want that growth, they want to add expansion teams. They want to be able to go and sell this league to prospective owners. They believe they need to have the stability of labor peace. They need to have a long-term contract where they say, yes, our labor is stable. This is a good thing. We're going to be building and growing. The other big issue is average team revenue is the term ATR, or lacrosse-related revenue, and how they see it. And increases to the minimum and maximum pay for players would be tied to increases in lacrosse-related revenue. And the league is leans towards a drop count figure, or, you know, attendance, basically. How many people actually go to games? And the players are saying, hey, there's all kinds of ways to make revenue. There's, you know, digital sales, there's sponsorship, there's, you know, there is expansions, all these things, and they want that to everything to factor in. So they want to see a bit more information. So that's a very important point, because the league doesn't want to open up the books, especially because the more you look at, like, concessions and parking and all these things, with teams being owned by, say, NHL teams and things, you've got Kroenke Sports, you've got Pagula Sports and Entertainment, you know, the Vancouver Canucks, the Flames, you've got all these different groups that are involved. You know, they're not going to open up the books of the Buffalo Bills when you're dealing with the Pagulas or the Sabres or the, you know, the Canucks and things. So, but the players are saying, we don't want that. We want to see just things that lacrosse does generate revenue and a share of that. And you can, I really see both sides where, you know, it's a very challenging, contentious issue. Where I was surprised was because I thought that Wednesday's proposal from the players addressed that in a way, because they went to a five-year contract, which is closer to what the owners would want and seems like a good compromise. And they had said, let's go now with this five-year contract. The first 2 years will be the way you're suggesting, the drop count. That's how increases will be tied. But then during that time, we agree to negotiate in good faith to find how we want to calculate average team revenue, what's going to be involved. And if we can't come up with an agreement by January 1st, 2020, then each side has a month to opt out of the agreement, which would be after two seasons. So that's where, I mean, for the league, I think, they just, I think I can't speak for them completely, but obviously they want a longer term. And I think the thing that when you look at the proposal, the players did add some things like in the fifth year, this would happen. In the fourth and fifth year, this would happen. And it's increases that are guaranteed increases to various things like bonus pay and playoff money and these things that would add a lot. So from the player's perspective, they want to share in the growth. And I totally get that. And they deserve to share in the growth. From the league's perspective, if you own an NLL franchise, there's a very good chance you've been losing money for a long time. And a fair bit of it. And they are concerned about adding guaranteed expenses 4 and 5 years from now when the growth of the revenues is not guaranteed.
That was an excellent summary of the current status quo. That being said, I think there's a lot of context that's really important for fans to understand everything that you just laid out. And so I want to start at a very rudimentary level, which is the PLPA stands for the Pro Lacrosse Players Association, and it operates functionally very similar to the players associations that fans are familiar with through the NFL, the NBA, Major League Baseball, what have you. They completed a six-year CBA after the season that ended in 2018. That deal was signed in a much different financial climate, both in terms of sports in North America and certainly in terms of the NLL, its front office, and its owners. And as a result, it's fair to say that the players essentially sacrificed a lot in order to get that CBA done and ensure that the league persisted. They conceded a lot of elements of the negotiation, and it put them on a pretty, I guess, for lack of a better word, weak position to begin this CBA negotiation for two reasons. Not only because their starting point was artificially lower than it would have been if it had been a straight line up from, you know, the last decade and the progress that had been made over the previous 20 years, right? So essentially the players agreed to more of a plateau and in some elements a little bit of a decline than the line leading to that point had suggested. And then secondly, two things have happened in NLL since the last CBA was signed. The front office completely changed over, led by new commissioner Nick Sakevich. And since he took leadership, the amount of new ownership groups that have entered the league has been substantial. And not only that, but they've also been really sophisticated, high-level, high-dollar ownership groups. You mentioned the Vancouver NHL ownership group acquiring the NLL team, and then obviously through expansion, the Philadelphia Flyers ownership group entered the league, and then also through expansion, Joe Tsai, who in addition to all that he's done in the sport of lacrosse, also owns the Brooklyn Nets, has created the San Diego franchise. And so for those two reasons, the players rightfully expect more, but not only are they negotiating against a new entity that doesn't have the historical perspective that the previous regime would have, you know, they also have shown themselves to be very effective negotiators and salespeople in getting these groups to come to the table of the league. And so I guess how do you regard all that entire ecosystem, you know, relative to how it colors this negotiation?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, the previous CBA came and it was, they opted out. So there, it would have gone till after 2020 season, but the players opted out on January 1st of this year. They had a November opt-out date. They could have, and they asked for an extension. They wanted to see more numbers from the league. And the players feel like they didn't see the numbers they needed to see. The league has a different perspective, as always in a negotiation. Each side has its own view, but the players opted out on January 1st, which triggered the need for a new negotiation. So the climate, like you said, 6 years ago, it was, they actually did basically a 1-year gap agreement, and then signed the new CBA in 2013. So it was a 2012 negotiation that carried over for a year. But at that time, there had been franchises failing and moving. I mean, franchises folding. There had been franchises moving. There was a lot of instability. The league was not in very strong shape. And the players went to the owners and said, hey, because the owners were saying, we can't give you anything, basically, in terms of increases. And we need to add some games. We need to do some things. And the players said, we have to see your books. The owners, the league, gave them lots of information. And the players, my understanding is the players' accountant group or accountant looked at it and said, they're actually serious. If you don't just basically hold the line here, the league will probably fold and there will be no league for you to play in. So the players took no increases in salaries, basically. Salaries, technically, because the season went from 16 to 18 games and they got the same salaries, the per game salary average per player actually dropped. So they haven't had any increases. The players feel justifiably like they took a big hit in terms of growth so the league could survive and thrive and grow. And now the players are saying, hey, we've been in this situation for 6 years and we want to be part of this growth. We want to enjoy the fruits of that growth. And I think the way you could characterize the league's perspective is it's just starting. This is Nick Sienkiewicz's third year with the new group that are running the NLL, and things are happening. I mean, you talked about Joe Tsai coming in, is fantastic, running San Diego Seals. You've got the Rochester moving to Halifax, which, however, if you're a fan of Rochester, you might not be so happy, but there's a lot of positives in that. And the new expansion team coming into Rochester, owned by the Vagulas, should be in a lot better situation because their lease with the Red Cross Arena will be substantially different. It will be vastly different to the old lease, which was really hindering the Nighthawks. So you can see from both perspectives, the players have this players association. And the interesting thing, a lot of players don't even have agents, just do their own contracts. A lot of them do, but many don't. But then you do have the player reps, and each team has a player rep for the team, and then they're negotiating committee with Dave Sucamore and Peter Schmitz are heading that, and they're saying, hey, we need to get some increases. We've been stagnant. We need to get more. We need a bigger piece of the pie now, or at least the same piece of a bigger pie, the same portion of a bigger pie. And I think the big thing the league would counter is saying is, yeah, we absolutely want you to share in the growth. We have to make sure the growth is sustainable and is happening before we commit to sharing 5 years from now or 6 years from now, sharing money that we hope will be there, we believe will be there, but we don't know will be there.
It's interesting in the way that it dovetails with what I understand to be part of the way that the league positions itself to NBA NHL owners, which is this is a product that will give you more additional dates to open the doors of your arena, and we'll see how the fan base develops in your market, because there is a track record of success in Buffalo and Toronto and certainly Calgary, Denver, etc., where basically the fan base has been able to, kind of either replicate the NHL team or the NBA team's fan base, or kind of cultivate a new group of attendees to the arena. But there have been other franchises that are currently operating that haven't met that level of success. And I think particularly because the percentage growth is about to be 50% of a third of the teams in the league in a couple of years will have only played one, two, or three seasons. The track record of their revenues isn't strong enough to be able to, and this is me stating the league's argument, make the commitments that the players are asking for. That being said, let's just turn this focus to, kind of back to what recently unfolded, which is the league's willingness to say, we will cancel 2 weeks of games, sacrifice the momentum of two brand new franchises making their debut, or in Philadelphia's case, making its return, for the sake of showing the players exactly how serious we are about our demands. So what can you tell us about two things? Number one, how serious the league actually is and how willing they are to continue to jeopardize this momentum. And number two, the players' reaction.
I think the league is very serious. I mean, they've shown they've canceled 2 weeks. And back in 2007 or 2008, the league actually said, under Jim Jennings as the commissioner, said, that's it, the season's canceled. Where they were having a labor negotiation, they said, we can't come to an agreement, the season's canceled. A few weeks later, they said, oh, we got it sorted out, we're having a season. And they're not going to do that now. If they say the season is canceled, I think the season will be canceled. You can see they're saying, you know, we're canceling 2 weeks. They're going to go as necessary. But my understanding from everyone that I've talked to is if they had to cancel the season, if they had to miss the season, the league would be willing to do it, which is extreme and very serious. But I think they feel they have to ensure the continued success or the that the league can survive and thrive. So I think they'll do it. The reaction from the play, if they need to. We certainly hope it won't come to that, and I think most people want it to happen, to have a season. But things get so contentious when you're negotiating that I think there's a certain amount of angry reaction, and you hope that, you know, obviously the ideal is to have time to cool off a bit and make decisions based on logic and not on emotion. But it's hard to divorce the emotion when these are people you work with all the time, the players and the owners and the coaches and managers. And now you're having the confrontation because of this negotiation. For the players' reaction is, I think it's mixed. I think there are some who are very strong saying, hey, we have to sacrifice. Curtis Dixon sent out a tweet saying, in replying to Andrew Suter. Andrew Suter was like, hey, why aren't we voting on this as a union? Like, hey, PLPA, why aren't you polling your members? Why can't we vote on this deal? And Curtis Dixon said, hey, sometimes, you know, they were going back and forth, and Dixon said, hey, I'd like to get paid, but sometimes you have to sacrifice for the good of future generations. And I think there are players who would like to just play. And I think the league may count. I mean, leagues tend to look at the players and think they won't be as unified as, you know, 200-plus players may not be as unified as 11 owners and the commissioner's office. And that generally in most negotiations would probably be the case, right? The larger the group, the more likely there's going to be differences of opinion. And I think there are a number of players who would say, let's just play. Let's just take these. Because there have been a lot of agreements for, a four-year contract or five-year, six-year contract. Let's just take it. You know, we're getting some raises. Let's go play. Let's play lacrosse. Let's get paid. let's do this thing we love. So I think there is a very real, there's some challenges for the player's side that is pretty typical of labor negotiations.
Okay, so two factors being laid mm-hmm. out. The first is the players' reasonable requests on the basis of the extended, 6-year term of the prior CBA, and then the, kind of split perspective on, we've had deals that have been put in front of us that are good enough, let's take it and play, versus the point that Curtis Dixon made, which I'm sure is shared by many, which is sometimes you need to sacrifice in order to improve the quality of the situation for future generations. We've seen two examples involving many folks in this allotment of players in the last 4 months that are important contextually. Number one was the extended negotiation between the NLTPA, I believe that acronym is right, but it can be very confusing, the National Lacrosse Team Players Association with the CLA, and then the formation of the Premier Lacrosse League, which in some regards could be seen as the manifestation of a grievance against labor in MLL. So what's your interpretation of the notion that players are becoming more sophisticated and their standards are increasing, and that is an important part of this puzzle?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. and I think a valid one, certainly with the Canadian national team standoff. It was, again, it was some of the same guys, obviously. I mean, Curtis Dixon is an example of a guy who was part of that. Jeff Snyder was really kind of a driving force in that negotiation, and they were adamant that they were not going to go to the World Championships unless they got a deal that was good for not just the men's national team, but all the teams, the men's field and box teams, the women's field team, the U19 boys and girls field teams, that it represent all of the national teams that everyone have. And there are lots of issues there that get sticky because there are players all over the world who are paying their own way to go to World Championships and European Championships and things. And the Canadian players were saying, hey, we don't want to be paying $8,000 to go to this tournament, which is reasonable because I think on the other side, there was money available to fund some of this. And there was a lot of back and forth that they really did dig their heels in. And then there were some things the CLA just would not give up on. They removed directors. And the players said, we want those directors back. That was one of the prongs of their argument. Those directors didn't come back. So in the end, they did reach an agreement. It was very last minute, but the players were able to go and compete at the World Championships, and there is a deal in place. It got very quiet once things were agreed on. Everyone just kind of stopped talking and said, okay, it's sorted out, let's just go. But I think it is a good example of the players standing firm and the power that can give you if you all do stand as one. I think the PLL is a fascinating development because, Paul Rabil is saying it's a league driven by the players, for the players. The players are the owners of this league. It's right now it's the traveling concept. It's like, the Harlem Globetrotters kind of approach where you're moving around and having the games and you're not geographically linked teams, which eventually I think they do want to have, right? But yeah, for sure, the players not happy with the Major League Lacrosse. In many ways, the huge leak of information was a major factor, but so many other things that MLL players just not happy with in terms of finances and lots of other factors. So I think that's an interesting correlation or parallel with the PLL. And somebody, I can't remember who it was, I did see a tweet, I think, from a player saying, hey, Paul Rabil, think PLL approach would work for box? Want to talk or something? Like, I'm sure Paul Rabel's busy enough getting the PLL going, but who knows? I mean, that's certainly interesting. I don't think we're going down that road. I don't see somebody creating a rival league to the NLL. I think players are invested, and there's so much invested in it that the way to go is to keep this entity intact. But certainly players are to an extent, and in some cases, showing great unity and power.
So where do we go from here? I hesitate to ask you that question because it feels like I'm putting you on the spot. And the reason I feel that way is because I don't have an answer to that question right now.
Well, the thing to me is that I'm disappointed in from both sides. I've seen, messages and I've heard things where both sides are saying, hey, call us anytime. We're available 24/7. The players are like, hey, let's negotiate. The league is like, hey, give us a call. And yet they didn't, for instance, like this weekend. I don't know what the negotiating process is right now. There are conversations going back and forth, emails. I mean, I've had the privilege of seeing a lot of the correspondence between entities and the proposals. And I can tell you that there are gaps between when things are happening. And maybe this is happening, I don't know, but I would like to see both sides locked in a room this weekend and not leaving until this is hammered out, because I think it's actually close enough that things can happen. And I would like to see everyone be told, you're not leaving until you sort this out, and that part, a big part of that obviously is me wanting this to happen. I love this league. I love the players and the teams and I just think it's a fantastic thing that is good for lacrosse and good for all of us that are part of it. And it's such a big part of my life. And it's nowhere near as important to me, obviously, as the people that own the teams and play for the teams. So I know they want this to happen. I think there will be, as players now start to miss their pay, I think there'll be an escalation in the urgency from the players to get it done. I think they will push. To me, I guess a big factor will be, when does the PLPA vote en masse as a full association, a full membership, on a contract proposal from the league? Because not every, you know, not every little tweak and adjustment to an offer is going to go for a full membership vote. It would be unwieldy to try and have everyone voting all the time. That's why you have player representatives for each team. But at some point, I think it's going to have to happen. And I'd be very curious to see what happens, because I think there may be, as they're now missing, I think very shortly, missing the first pay period check. It's very complicated how they get paid. It's not you get a game check. It's divide. You get basically paid per day for every day you're on the roster, active roster, based through the course of the season. You get that certain percentage of your salary, and it's like a biweekly thing. So they're missing paychecks. And that, you look at any NFL negotiation, Major League Baseball, anything, as soon as players start to miss paychecks, the urgency ramps up. And I think that's going to push things. And I think, I honestly feel like we're close enough that I still retain some optimism that it can get worked out. Now, you see the responses where, you know, one side will send a proposal and say, hey, here's our, you know, this is a proposal, and we think it's really good. And the other side, you're thinking, oh, yeah, they're going to say, oh, okay, what about we just do this and that? And instead the other side says, no, we don't like your offer. I know the players are upset that they feel the league has sent them the same offer three times, hasn't been adjusting. The league, I know, feels like, and they have, compromised on a number of issues and given in on a bunch of things. So both sides have very strong points. And I don't know, I don't want to assess blame on anyone. I just want to call work out. And I'm hoping that they're talking right now as we're talking.
So I guess, not knowing what unfolds here in the future, how do you assess fans' reaction, the damage that's been done already, the damage that could or will be done over the course of the next 4 weeks, presuming there isn't some 11th hour restoration of the seven games that have been canceled, whether or not they get rescheduled and made up later in the year, or if there's some other adjustment that's made that allows for the standings to be valid as we head into the postseason. What is your perspective on, again, the damage that's been done, that will be done if the announcement that has been made is followed, and that's it? Then between now and the next deadline, a deal gets made and we move forward starting in mid-December.
I'm going to address the games part first, because the stats geek in me freaks out when I think there could be an uneven schedule of things, because some teams played twice in those first 2 weeks. Some teams didn't play at all. I think Philadelphia didn't play at all. Toronto, I know, played twice. There are other teams, you know, some teams played once. I think four teams may have played twice, two or four teams played twice, and like five, a bunch of teams played once, and then some teams didn't play. So it's very uneven. Are they, you know, if they make those up later in the year, it's going to be cramming some things in. They can't redo the whole schedule. Well, they could, but I don't think they can redo the whole schedule. There are other challenges. Like, I know venues are saying, hey, we've got a bunch of dates blocked for, say, an Ariana Grande concert or a Meghan Trainor concert, and we need to know when to book them, so you have to tell us soon or we're just going to go ahead.
So there's challenges with those very modern references. I'm impressed.
Yeah, somebody had to explain to me who Meghan Trainor was. Apparently she's a singer.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah, okay. So I'm not as modern as I may have sounded. I do know Ariana Grande. But I think they've got to figure something out. I don't see how you can have some teams play 16 games, some play 17, some play 18. So there's got that, to me, is very interesting. I'll be very curious to see how it works out. In terms of the fans, fans are very upset, and I get it. And they're angry, and they seem to be, for the most part, for what you see on social media, and that the fans that are active are supporting the players. You don't see a lot of people saying, hey, players, come on, sort this out. You know, the league's giving you a good offer. I think the fans generally are in the players' side, and that's partly because the players have been more open about what's happening, and the league has said, we don't want to negotiate in public, in the court of public opinion, which, you know, is admirable, and yet it also is going to have them painted as the bad guy, for the most part, right? I do think what we've seen in the history of sports negotiations is fans get very upset. You will lose some fans. There are fans you will lose forever because of labor unrest, which is understandable, but I think most people come back. I think fans are fans because they love the game, because they love the sport, the players, and they'll come back. I think they will. And I don't mean to diminish what it means to fans who are upset about the unrest, who are upset about games being canceled, about everything that goes on involved with a negotiation like this, because it does affect them viscerally and emotionally. But I think generally they'll come back.
So, yeah, I come down on multiple sides.
Right?
Well, of course. Yeah. But I actually think that let me just kind of share my thoughts, and I want you to react as opposed to, you know, framing this as a question. So the fans are always going to side with players over ownership. Number one, fans have a greater affinity for players. They're not a fan of the owners, right? Number two, most fans can relate more easily to workers than they can to bosses. So I get that. I do.
And especially, sorry if I can interject, especially in this case where, you know, you've got franchise players making $38,000.
Exactly.
The veteran maximum is $32,000. There can be an affinity, like the NHL in the 1970s or the NFL, you know, before Major League Baseball, everything back when players' salaries were more in line with what other people made. Whereas, I mean, there's less affinity, right, when somebody's making $20 million a year.
Totally.
And you're at home saying, wow, I've got to pay my ticket prices, and you're complaining because you're only making $20 million this year. So, yeah, anyway.
I tend to have more, I don't know if sympathy is the right word, but I see the NLL, I see the league's point of view better than I typically would for two reasons. Number one, because as I said earlier, I think a lot of this is a hinge moment in the league's development. The infusion of new owners is not as much of an indicator of the health of the league as many people might assume. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done to increase overall league revenue in order for the increases that have been offered to the players to be sustainable, which is a word that you very accurately used. Not to mention the fact that the idea of a two-year opt-out, if we can't agree on the definition of lacrosse-related revenue, essentially makes it a two-year deal. Like, I get how it is a veiled five-year proposal, but if you have a two-year opt-out, that is essentially going to be the most important and difficult thing to negotiate, then it's a two-year deal. So from the league's perspective, if expansion is the number one priority, which I think through actions and words, Nick Šekević has made it very clear that that is the league's most substantial priority, I would agree with him that extended labor peace is a key component to making that sell, new franchise sells, easier, then a two-year deal isn't going to cut the mustard. So I kind of, again, have a little bit more sympathy for the league than I might otherwise traditionally, you know, looking at other labor negotiations. And to the point about fans coming back, you know, number one, when I think about the, you know, I'm a fan of the Cleveland Indians, the 94 Major League Baseball strike sacrificed their first good season in like 100 years. So I'm sympathetic to like what it means when labor negotiations derail the on-field product. But that being said, the NLL, in line with a lot of the conversation that we've already had, is at a point where the existing fan, the value of the existing fan relative to the value of the future fan is, you know, typically 90% of the value comes from your existing fans. The league's in a place in time where the value of the future fan is way higher than it typically is. And so my question really does more center around the idea of how many folks in San Diego or Philadelphia were going to go to a game for the novelty and they had their eyes set on the first game. And now that first game isn't happening, like, now they're just not going to go at all. You know what I mean? And that's where I see, I use the term momentum. I see this as being like a one-shot opportunity that, like, when I ask how serious the NLL's actions are, I agree with you. I think that canceling the first 2 weeks of the season is a really drastic action that, you know, is more than just a symbolic symbol.
Yeah, and I mean, I actually just went on the schedule to look at the to check out all the teams, and it actually has been updated and shows December 15th as week one, which is interesting. I hadn't seen that before on the site. So, yeah, and it's interesting you bring up Cleveland and the Indians, and I mean, I was a Montreal Expos fan, and I'll tell you, the year that they should have gone to the World Series and a strike or a walkout, whichever it was, made that not happen was pretty much the end of me being a passionate Major League Baseball fan.
It was the same year. The Indians should have played the Expos in the 94 World Series.
Yeah, it would have been a great series. Those were amazing teams. And I was on the other side of that fence, and that was it for me. I have not felt the same way about Major League Baseball since. So as much as I think I said a lot of fans will come back, when you bring that up, I'm like, yeah, that's a good point. There are fans who won't. There are fans who won't. And the schedule, I know, I mean, San Diego was going to have their first ever home game, right? Vancouver, the Warriors were going to have their first home game in their, you know, in their new arena as the Warriors, not the South. And so there's a lot of things. Philadelphia still has their home opener coming up on December 15th. So that right now has not been canceled. It's obviously in jeopardy. So yeah, it's a big step to cancel games. And I think I hear different things in San Diego. Obviously, you don't walk around San Diego right now and see Wings stuff or SEAL stuff everywhere and hear people talking about the SEALs. And that would be almost impossible to be the case because you have to create your footprint. But what footprint you were creating, people that were excited say, oh, wow, you know, this is great. We're going to be playing. We're going to go see this. This is so cool. The SEALs are surfacing. Really neat branding thing they've got going on. Well, now they're not surfacing. So, yeah, it's... Yeah, I hope it doesn't have a long-term impact.
Well, unfortunately, that's kind of the place we have to end, because as I said, I don't really know what the forecast is, and typically that's the case in labor negotiations. Obviously, we can turn to the last-minute deal that salvaged the Canadian national team's presence in Israel and didn't have an effect on that tournament, and hope that a similar path unfolds as far as the NLL and PLPA labor negotiations are concerned. Stamper, like I
yeah,
said.
Yeah, let me just throw in one other thing, because I meant to mention, and you know, we've been talking about this, and you know, talking about the affinity and people's sympathy with folks. And I mean, I know a lot of players. I'm very friendly with a lot of players in the NLL. I think there's a lot of great people, great guys who are doing this for the passion of the game and trying to make what they can out of the game, because they are the amazing athletes, the best lacrosse players in the world, and they deserve it. And you know, but great guys. And on the ownership side, I know a lot of the owners and the managers and things of these teams, and they're terrific people too. They are also just as passionate about this league. I don't think anyone is taking this cavalierly. And that is, I think, the one thing that people will say, oh, they just don't care. You know, the other side, they just don't care. They're just trying to do this or that. I think both sides care very passionately and are very sincere in what they're trying to do. And they both believe, at whichever end of the spectrum they're on in this negotiation, they both believe they are doing what they need to for the good of the league and the game. And it's coming from their own perspective, but I really don't think that anyone doesn't care. And I think that's really important to remember.
Certainly agree with that. But that'll do it for this emergency podcast Isle Indoor Saturday edition. Stamper, as always, we appreciate your time. When this develops next, we'll have you back on and get some more context, and hopefully that's to talk about the beginning of the 2018-19 NLL season.
I have my fingers crossed as we're saying that.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.